This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
My name is Joel Smith. I'm the curator of photography here at the Morgan Library, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to Accumulated Wisdom, The Collector as Inventor. Tonight's 10 presentations explore the kinship or the continuum between collecting and creating. The event accompanies the exhibition Upstairs, a collective invention, photographs of clay, in which the treasures of the Morgan are combined with those of 25 creative collectors and strung into a continuous adventure. Tonight marks the first collaboration between the Morgan and Cabinet, and I am grateful to Cabinet's fearless and tireless leader, Sina Najafi, as well as to all 10 of tonight's presenters. The speakers will be introduced on screen. And so this is the last that you're going to hear from the management tonight, who, by the way, has a cold and therefore is glad to be out of it. The festivities begin and end tonight with presentations by artist lenders to the exhibition, beginning with Mr. Harvey Tolsensky speaking on his collection of real photo postcards. Please welcome Harvey Tolsensky.
Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Collecting for me has always been a very personal search for something essential that I guess I felt was missing or that I needed to complete a mystery, a story, and that story was my story. As a child, I would find things along my path, pick them up, put them in my pockets, and these objects, these mundane objects or mundane to others, stones, pieces of metal discarded, pieces of paper, twigs, held special meaning to me. I don't know what that meaning was, but I invented meaning. I would pick them up, and I did this so often that my mother would always have to mend the pockets of my jackets and my pants. This is something more contemporary. This shows you that in some ways I really never grew up. I still pick things up, put them in my pockets, only now I have a house where I can place them on windowsills, pieces of furniture, or benches. Many of these objects are from a collection called Things Sort of Shaped Like Vermont. So this childhood, tick of picking things up and collecting them was my first experience collecting, but also my first experience creating a narrative from what I collected. My father had a toy store, and next to his toy store was a field, and I would rummage through this field, picking things up, and I set up my own little store with turned over milk cartons in which I would place these objects, and I would sit there and I would invent stories with and about them. It wasn't necessarily that I had a store next to his store. Mine was probably more like a gallery. And I would just sit there for hours with these stories. So now you can go on with your regular slides. Postcards came 30 years later. I started collecting postcards as a way of trying to invent an imaginary life that I had once had before the one I now have. I had bought a house in Vermont, and I had the intention of, I bought land in Vermont, house came later, and I had the intention of building a house studio on this land, and I felt that I needed a proper identity to inhabit this house. And so this sort of search began in finding old postcards in antique stores and various places like that around Vermont, where I would find these old images of Vermont, and I would use these to sort of create my new life, my personal image of the person I thought I was before I became the person I am. So this went on for years. The idea came, you know, I told you how the idea came to me, and the finding the cards at first was just sort of casual, but I became addicted to these images, and I began searching them out. And like in all endeavors of discovery, as Robert Frost says, way leads on to way. And the collecting became far more serious. And I'm just going to interrupt for 1 second. This card, which I found in the postcard shop in Vermont, just joined my collection without me thinking much about it, except it was a nice card. Years later, I met an 87-year-old woman who had lived in the house that I eventually bought in Vermont. And I was looking through her postcards, and I found this card. And I said, Marjorie, I have that same card. And she said, well, that's me, right? So there was an instance of real life, not imaginary life, coming together with my collection. At the time that I was collecting these cards, I still had this fantasy of recreating this life. I can't really call it a lost life, because I had to establish it first. But something else was going on. And at the time, I didn't really know what was going on, but what was going on was I was beginning to become a real collector. I was building a collection. The cards themselves, as I collected them, began to pull me in various directions. And at the beginning, while the cards were all of Vermont, there was still plenty. There were people, there were farms, there were houses, there were cities, there were inventions, there were personal stories, there were strange things. But after a while, it stopped just being Vermont. Vermont just became one of the subjects, and it opened up a whole world, world upon world upon world, that I just became so fascinated with. These cards are really beautiful, I love them. As I began developing a sense of what it was I thought I was really looking for, I would discover something new that would open up a new vein of exploration for me and totally expand what I thought I was collecting. I began to ask dealers if they had quirky cards, and nobody knew what I meant. What I meant were things, you know, that were out of the ordinary, things that weren't easily categorized. And they could be things that people wouldn't value very much. Accidental double exposures, or a card that was uninteresting except for some detail that most people didn't notice. Well, in the back of my mind, I kept inventing and looking for this prior existence. The collection began to take all my energy as a collection, and the lost identity began to fade as the cards and the collection itself became the main thing. For me, collecting always was about inventing, whether it was a story about me or trying to figure out someone else's story from the cards I found. It was always about creating, placing myself as the collector. collector in the center of this continuously expanding flow of accumulation, which to me is collecting. As the collection grew, my vision grew, and the cards became like the objects that I would pick up as a child and put in my pocket. They became the pieces of a puzzle that, when assembled, would reveal the hidden narrative. I'm still assembling them. The narrative is getting larger and larger, and I can't honestly say I know what it is. I enjoy putting it together. And it is the act of collecting that is inventing the story. Enjoy the cards. Thank you.
I'm a collector of coffee lids. With my architecture partner, Scott Specht, we have an architecture practice. But before the architecture practice kicked off, we both noticed that we had begun to notice. And I think part of the pleasure of collecting is actually the noticing. And I teach a class, I also teach at NYU. And one of the things I talk about to my students is learning to look. I don't know that we spend enough time doing that. So in the most ordinary, throwaway culture that we inhabit, and especially with drink through coffee lids, which I'll speak about, I started noticing in 1984 when I was in college that we as a culture thought it was important not just to drink coffee, but to take it with us somewhere else to drink it, which is part of the Deco culture. So we had lids that we would put on top of the cup of coffee, and we would take it somewhere and then drink it. And as a college student, we would take it to class or to the yard or to the park and drink it. But the coffee culture developed because we decided we didn't need to just take it somewhere and drink it, we needed to drink it while taking it. So this is the idea that what happens when you get, this is one of the earliest patented coffee lids, the Dixie Corporation, where you don't see any way, you see indications of what is in the coffee, sugar, cream and sugar, black. But then you don't know. Then what happens in 1984-86 is that we as a culture, and this is a uniquely American phenomenon, have decided that, in fact, it was actually very important to take our cup to go and drink it while going. And going could be walking or driving, or sometimes riding a bicycle. And so I started noticing that all the various places one would buy a cup of coffee offered the option to go. And at that time, there were so many different to-go lids that I noticed that I started collecting them. And I would get one or two of them at a time, so I had multiples. And then I noticed there were even more, and even more. So I'm here tonight as I'm the owner of the largest collection of independently patented drink-through lids in the world. With Scott Specht, we own the URL coffeelids.com. We get precisely 3 hits every 6 months. I will say, is deep and in no way broad. There is no real community of coffee lid collectors that I know. But one of the things that happen, and with any collector, when you have more and more and more, and you keep noticing, I know every lid that I have. I know what is new, what is not new, what's a slight variation on the one I already have, therefore should I get it? I probably should get it, because there's a conversation there. But one of the things that happened in my case is that I started to try as a collector to categorize things, to come up with some kind of a taxonomy. What are we really seeing here? Because in the architecture world, there's this kind of throwaway trope, which is completely false. Oh, form follows function. And then you look at this and you say, really? Because the function is to keep the hot coffee mostly in the cup and to get it to your mouth when you want it. And if that was easy to solve, there would only be one lid. But of course, there's many lids. At this, as of this count, I have 229 independently patented drink-through coffee lids. So we developed an idea about taxonomy. And so the first idea of the taxonomy, the very first thing was with like the little Dixie lid I showed, where people would just little peel it from the outside and make what we call this like wedge-shaped guitar pick. That's the design writer Phil Patton, who wrote about this for ID Magazine. And he and I both, and I agree with him, that's exactly what it looks like, this little kind of ragged wedge that we call the guitar pick. But then the designers, the design community answered that call to say, well, if this is what people are doing, is peeling it back, let's figure out a way to reliably peel it back. So the first category is the peel type of lid. And so that's an example on the bottom left where we can peel it back. And then there's also the subcategory of the peel and lock. So there's actually a positive lock. You can peel it out, then you can peel it back and reseal it. And so that's the peel. There's a whole category of the peel lids. Then you look at the other lids. And this I would call the pinch lid. So there's another type of lids where you literally pinch off the lid and kind of hook it onto the side of the cup. So you've got this little lid, it gets pinched off, it lives on the side of the cup, and then as you're only drinking half the cup of coffee now and you're going somewhere else, you drink the other half, you kind of put it back in place, and that's the pinch type lid. Not a very successful type of lid, not so many of them, but that's an example of that one. Then we get the pucker lid, which is Hello Sippy Cup, right? So you're sticking your mouth on this thing and it's kind of coming towards you. We call this the proboscis. So it's actually bringing the liquid out towards your mouth and you're going. So that is the pucker type of lid. And then the final lid that we were talking about was the puncture lid. And you'll notice that this is a very robust lid. It's got five braces to brace the perimeter. So when you punch through with the mouth aperture, the lid won't collapse into the hot coffee. And so there's a whole group of these, and they used to call these at that point the extreme lids, and these kind of like, you know, really tough guy lids. Like the lid is much tougher because the idea of, you know, having to punch through it, we've solved the problem in so many different ways. Why this is seen as a better idea, but to get patented, you have to show difference and improvement. And this actually was, in the patent designation, was shown to have superior delivery. Okay, so it had superior delivery. One of the things that when you start collecting, you're just like, well, where did this all start? And so I started looking through the patent registry, and this is what I call the elusive Stubblefield lid, is that I'm not sure this was ever put into production, but this is the earliest set of drawings I found of a drink-through reusable lid. 1934 it was filed, patent granted in 1935. So, again, there were many lids. This one was probably for cold liquids, but again, a number of the early patents reference this as the relationship of the lid to the cup. And in the registration, it talks a lot about friction fit, which is how the lid has to sit on the cup, or positive mating. So again, the cup and the lid have to mate. Again, and this maybe suggests some other type of activity other than drinking a cup of coffee. But again, I've never seen the elusive Stubblefield lid, but it's kind of in my mind. So I do think this is where the collector comes in, not just the noticing, but the things that come to you in your ordinary daily life versus the going out and looking for. So I actually have crossed over. I am now in the going out and looking for phase. So this is probably the most widely recognized lid. This is a solo traveler lid. Jack Clements patented this. It's the one that's included in the Museum of Modern Art's collection. This would actually clearly come into the pucker category, but it has a little problem. Anybody who's used this knows the problem. It's like some of us have noses. And so one of the things that happens when you drink this coffee is your nose is right on the edge of the lid. I think that this hasn't been enough of a deterrent that people don't buy the coffee with this lid, but again, there is a whole series of other innovations that have come since this lid. because it doesn't solve the nose problem and it's not resealable, so there's like a sort of splash or slosh factor. Solo should solve this problem in part themselves, is that, and many of us have seen this, so this is the rotational solo traveler lid, which is that it's open and then with a flick of a hand it rotates and is self-closing. So a number of us have seen this, our friends at 7-Eleven have this. And this is one of my new favorites, which is what I call the red band-aid lid. So Think Coffee Downtown uses this lid, and again, it's very, I think it's kind of handsome even, and Prada looking a little bit. This is, I call this my little Prada lid. So it's got this little red bandage open and closed. And again, one of the things that you think about when you have white coffee lids is that the coffee lids always look brown because the coffee is splashing out. So the black lids actually solve that problem too. The color is not part of the patent designation, but again, I think the popularity of this lid, especially downtown, might have something to do with the fact that it doesn't look a mess all the time too. This is the group that I call the kind of Darth Vader lids. There's a whole group of lids that I think are just so hyper over-designed. They bring all of the kind of, the first-year designer actually brings everything he or she ever learned to the lid. So it's not, I don't know if there's a pointer thing, but you know, it's like a little image of the coffee in the porcelain cup on the plastic coffee lid that's going to go on a paper cup. So I just think that kind of, there's nested imagery here as well as this bravado of the handle with care and the kind of the big shoulders and the, I don't know, maybe it's the sort of the Testarossa of coffee lids, something like that. Then we come to mint. So another thing that happens, the coffee lid patents all say that these are reusable. These are reusable lids. So every time you throw away a lid, just realize that you kind of miss the moment to actually reuse that lid, because this is what, for all this plastic that we're putting in the environment that we shouldn't be, that's actually, you're supposed to be reusing that lid. These guys say, oh no, we're biodegradable. So we're actually using a different kind of plastic than they say on their website. We're neither mint flavored or do we smell like mint, we're just biodegradable. So this is another lid that you're starting to see to solve another problem, which is to say, we can actually change the composition of the lid itself and be more user-friendly. One of the things that comes up of the idea of the scratch and sniff lid. So now we have another lid, which is to say, we can actually bring another experience to your coffee drinking, is that it's not just about drinking the coffee, it's about experiencing something else, which is the scratch and sniff. So we have the aroma lid. In case you missed, there's a French press in built into a coffee lid now. This is one of my new favorites called the Cool Lid. A lot of people have had this experience, and of course there have been lawsuits about McDonald's coffee spilling on someone's lap, but the idea, the coffee's too damn hot. The run is too damn high. No, the coffee's too damn hot. But this has actually a small reservoir that actually pre-cools the coffee before it gets to you, and it's called the Cool Lid. These are the shop drawings. And then finally, what I brought tonight, I actually, the most recently patented lid came out on March 4th of this year, and I tracked down the designer who lives in Kissimmee, Florida, and he sent his new lid, it's called the Aroma Lid. And he actually has a smell pot that's built into the cup lid, where the warm, humid, kind of coffee rising comes through this aroma pot, and it brings the aroma as you're drinking the coffee. So he says, if you remember the old Folgers ad, so coffee will taste as good as it smells. And so I actually, he's thrilled to be part of this conversation tonight, and he sent me some samples, and these are some photographs. And these are the aromas that you can get, the custom aromas with him. I'm over time, but I'm just going to go quickly to say, to show you, who cares about this? Who cares about this? Paola Antonelli cares about this in MoMA. It's the MoMA's collection. Cabinet Magazine cares about this. My first article was published with Sina in 2005. The first show of the coffee lids was at Proteus Gowanus in a cabinet with Cabinet Magazine. The Atlantic cares about this. They wrote about us. Pagan Kennedy, the New York Times, wrote about the lid collection very recently. And at the end, we got a letter 2 years ago from the Smithsonian that they wanted to accession part of our collection for the permanent collection at the Smithsonian. So here's the letter. This humble, worthless collection made history. So
So I'm honored to be part of this horde of to honor the second day of Passover. Why is this night different from all other nights? Well, we've already seen. I'm an academic, and my collection comes from a need to find the objects that I wanted to write about. I'm a media theorist, and I'm interested in the history of the sending of the voice, voicemail, one could say. And in this project, the media archaeology of voicemail, I came upon an astonishing chapter. It turns out that starting in the teens, in the 20s, and then hugely in the 30s through the late 1950s, people were recording gramophone records in booths, at home, at touristic sites, and sending home-recorded audio letters all around the world, in America, in Europe, in South America, in the Soviet Union. So I started looking for them, but they were nowhere to be found. And so I started creating my own archive. And what I'm going to show you is just some samples from a large archive that I've built online of this forgotten chapter of media history, a moment when people for the first time were hearing, as the slogan of one label said, hearing themselves as others hear you. So this is 1929, Stern Brothers department store. Enclosed is a permanent personal phonograph record made in the speakerphone recording salon on the fifth floor. Very modern, modernized store, sponsored the speakerphone. Here's the record, an aluminum record. I'm going to play one at the very end. Single-sided, so the back is shiny and flat without grooves. These would be made real-time, so no editing, 1.5 to 2 minutes, depending on the speed. Early records were 78s, later they became 45s. And here's the sleeve, which explains to you some of how it works. You go in and you speak. When you're done, if you like, you could ask for an envelope and put it in the mail. The postman will deliver it, and voila! It's played on your home gramophone. These were normal gramophone records that could be played on any gramophone that by then were already very common in the home. Why, everybody asks, why have I never heard about these? Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of these were made. And this is a very good question, which would take longer than 10 minutes to answer, but the basic media historical problem that arises here is this. People associate the flat Berliner gramophone record with a delivery system, not as a recording medium. So that when you see a record like this, these would be recorded on the 86th floor of the Empire State Building. This is 1950. The envelope, here's the Empire State Observatory's record, ESO. People assumed that this was a commercial object and not an individually recorded gramophone disc. Where do I find these discs? In flea markets, on eBay, in strange record stores. But most of the time, these are ghosts, right? These are orphans. These are media orphans, people who die and this is found in their attic. I rarely know who these are, who made these. Here's one that was made also in the late 20s on board the SS Ile-de-France, at the longest gangplank in the world. another speakerphone disc. I want to show you the marvelous little So this is the argument for the superiority of an audio greeting, right? And we're looking at, this archive is basically coming into existence at a moment when voicemail, for all intents and purposes, is a thing of the past, right? Nobody sends voicemail anymore. I asked my students, do you guys get voicemail? And one of my students said, yeah, my mom sent me a voicemail about 3 weeks ago and I just found it. You know, they text. But the sending of the voice, which a certain generation among us remembers as an important and very modern and up-to-date domestic technology, is largely an anachronism. But then, at the time in the Second World War, was a huge proliferation of these discs. Soldiers would make them at USO stations around the world. This is one sent from the Philippines. People were very anxious about the idea that they could be potentially damaged in transit, but they were often made on cardboard with a very thin inscribable surface, metal as you saw. Here's the USO cardboard disc. Made by a specialized manufacturer, the Radio records manufacturer in Los Angeles. And these were some of the organizations that sponsored these records at various such stations in New York, in San Francisco, and throughout the world. A Letter on a Record, another USO production made in Paris, Texas, and sent to Laredo. What happens on these records is a kind of vernacular audio archive. Banal greetings, interesting invocations of extant technologies. What voice do I use when I speak in front of this microphone? Sometimes people use the model of telephony. Hi, Mom. How are you feeling? Pause. But it's not two-way communication. Or radiophony. This is station so-and-so signing off. Or theatrical forms of speech. This was recorded at the 1939 Golden Gate International Exposition in San Francisco, also a single-sided aluminum disc. Kudisc was a British brand that immediately got into trouble by virtue of its rather brazen ripoff of Kodak. Later examples of this bear the traces of the lawsuit that Kodak immediately filed, where it says, we have no relation whatsoever to the Kodak company. But this idea of snapshots of your voice was a trope that informed this phenomenon. The idea was you would make snapshots of, audio snapshots of daily life, a birthday, a performance, a party. And new forms of sociality were invented by the manufacturers. Have a recording party. Invite your friends over, and here's some scripts. You can read this role, you can read that role in case you don't know what to do. And this became, particularly during the Second World War, a way of empowering particularly women to use this new technology to produce new forms of home domestic amusement. Here's the disc. This is a British disc. Very bad audio quality, I'm afraid. In 1939, the International Postal Congress meets in Buenos Aires and decides on a new postal tariff. And a lot of my research has been looking at postal tariffs because where you have a new postal tariff for audio letters, there you have an index of a proliferation of such acoustic mail. Here it gives you the instructions on how to do it. The idea in Argentina was this would provide access to the epistolary form, to letter writing, for the pre-literate or the illiterate people could go to the post office, record a letter, here's one done in 1944, that they could then send, and if your mother in the northern Argentina didn't have a record player at home, she could play it at the post office. So this was opening up the letter form to people who didn't read or no longer read. Nazi voicemail. Soldiers in Nazi Germany would often wounded, would be in lazarettes, in medical stations, would be given the opportunity to send their voices home, just as American and other soldiers. Indeed, the military vectors of such audio mail are extensive. This is another version, the colonial version, the Dutch East Indies mail. You see the vector there from the mothership in Holland all the way down to Batavia. And I love the idea of the wheel, the motor of this transmission is itself the gramophone record. Stemmen uit Nederlands, voices from Netherlands. And here's the gesproken brief, the spoken letter. Again, a large format cardboard record. 1958 Brussels Exposition, a chocolate manufacturer, Meurice, decides to make a publicity by offering you the possibility of stepping into a booth, same kind of booth that you would use to make a photograph of yourself, photo booth. These would be photo booths, and you would just use, they're in fact using the American system, Voiceograph by the American Mutoscope Company, to record these records and then send them in a rather colorful packaging. And finally, Pepsi-Cola sponsored voice letter. from Your Man in Service from 1943. I thought we would take a listen to this. Don't be put off by the rather mediocre audio quality. Part of the interesting challenge of this project has been precisely to get a trace out of these strange artifacts that have been sitting in garages, abandoned and abused for half a century and more, and getting them to play. But I've provided a transcript so you can try to get a sense of what's being said. So hopefully this will work. Can we have the audio, please?
The voice of Mr. Herbert, controller center for service and weather, from Woodville, California.
Oh, man, I'm late. I'll bet you are. And when it's time to catch the promise, to wait a few more, to listen to the next test, well, my children will be much late. Even now we are around the clock. Don't worry, the only way they could have been home, best tank, and with all the pros. Give my best advice to everyone. Just keep remembering that I'm looking forward to staying home. Right. You have no idea how you're ready. Well, my time is up. So long for now. Both of us.
It's real time. He doesn't realize that the time of the record is still recording. And then somebody tells him, hey, you still got time.
I still want a paper today that they got a lot of snow up on my mind. If I could have been there now, like I was late, I could do it in a good time. Well, I just can't think of anything else to say now. Go on.
So what I have here is basically an archive, kind of phenomenology of medial hesitations, which is itself a really interesting media historical case study in what happens when people are learning to adapt to a new medium, the moment when, for the first time in history, they can, on a wide scale, record their own voices. Thank you.
Photography, like life in the modern world, is prone to accumulation. Nearly 4 years ago, I began visiting Peter Cohen, an avid collector of vernacular photography. Peter has been collecting snapshots for 25 plus years at flea markets, on eBay, and through private dealers. I'm interested in the similarities we share. Peter as a collector and myself as a photographer. So on the on my right is Peter's collection in boxes, and this is my accumulation of photographs that I've taken. Peter's desire to collect these objects not only lies in the childlike curiosity of looking at the fragments of the everyday, but a desire to create logic or narrative out of the chaos of life. For both of us, the process involves the pile-up of many images and then editing and organizing them based on discoveries and epiphanies. Peter describes his entrance into collecting vernacular photography as going right down the rabbit hole. The metaphor makes perfect sense when you think about photography and collecting. It's an adventure into the unknown, but what do you do with it? For Peter, the pleasures of collecting involve creating categories, anything from people on poles to a category he likes to call dangerous women. I began helping Peter organize these categories, and in the process of doing so, drifted away into his collection and began to pursue a more openly poetic and intuitive way of making sense of his trove of images. In the end, I was probably the worst help he ever had, which amounted to mostly taking countless images home to scan and play with. My visits with this collection evolved into daydreaming sessions. Out of these daydreaming sessions, Dive Dark, Dream Slow was made. The book was the ideal format for me to engage with the themes I began distilling from Peter's archive. In the book format, photographs appear as single shots and as elements of a larger whole. Together, the images push beyond the document and nostalgic surface. The isolated image as artifact is given a complexity of meaning through the structure of a group. Because our gaze is inherently restless, it's only when we see differences and repetition, comparison and contrast, where we are stimulated and relieved, and a dialogue between images begins. My editing goal here was to set a mood, to evoke feelings of anticipation, fear, and desire. Like an album of pop songs about a girl or civilization hovering on the verge of transformation, the book cycles through overlapping themes that sparkle with psychic longing and apocalyptic comedy. Came out around the time my paternal grandmother started traveling to Europe. She studied French in high school, but could not have imagined then that she would one day visit Paris. The souvenirs she collected on these journeys only came to light after her death, when we were emptying her apartment. On a manila envelope tucked between some books, she'd written European toilet paper. Inside were some 24 samples from various airports and hotels with information about their origins and sometimes the circumstances of their collection. It's terrible, just heartbreaking after someone dies, when family members squabble over the inheritance. But how delicious when you win the fight. The TP collection became mine. And it's figured over the years in my creative work. Most notably as the centerpiece in the European wing of a fictional nonprofit that I directed non-profitably for many years called the Mendelian World Museum. It was also the subject of a leftovers column for Mac Cabinet magazine. But I turned out to be a terrible custodian of this family legacy because I lost the collection. At some point in moving studios, the collection disappeared. Although collections of objects don't have biological life, it's not wrong to speak of a collection as living. It exhibits qualities of growth and change through a process of enactment by its collector. By extension, a collection can also die. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm a murderer. But perhaps all is not lost. I have photos of the collection, and in an attempt at redemption and resurrection, I will produce some of those images here with a brief narrative culled from a fictional travel journal such as my grandmother might have kept. Stopped to refuel at Gander before going on to London Airport, so modern. Not sure I love the decor, but the ladies' room is very nice. Marlene Dietrich, Elizabeth Taylor, Marilyn Monroe, they've all sat here, and who knows who else. Had to use the facilities twice, which I guess raised my chances of having occupied the same seat as somebody famous. London Airport. Saw a little pamphlet for sale called The Good Loo Guide. Read that the toilet paper used to have "Do not take away" printed on it right after "government property." Would have read more, but that Wilson character from our group stuck his nosy beak over my shoulder and wanted to know what I was reading. He should mind his own beeswax. Anyway, this paper didn't say "do not take away." E-D-O-U-A-R-D. 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 Shee, maninny, why don't they just throw an I in there while they're at it? Love to hear them try to spell C-I-N-C-I-N-N-A-T-I. On the bus to Versailles, that Wilson man had the gall to insert himself right next to me. He showed me the little Eiffel Tower souvenir he bought, and I've never seen anybody so pleased with himself in all my days. I told him I wasn't interested in reproductions, and that any souvenir I took home was going to be the real deal. Hope you brought a big suitcase, he said. Ah, he has no idea. Grand National Hotel in Lucerne. Wish you could be here with me, Mike. It's quite the place. Remember when we didn't have a nickel for a loaf of bread? You would have poked fun if you were here, I bet. Told me I was acting highfalutin and asked where the outhouse was. If it was a double holer with separate thrones for the king and queen. But you would have secretly been happy as a pig in clover. Palm trees at a beautiful flower market. Hotel is near the promenade by the beach. That Walter Wilson person asked if I wanted to take a stroll with him. Certainly not. Why would I want my view obstructed by the bulk of him? Anyway, he's a slowpoke. The way he shuffles along, the only race he's going to win is the one to the graveyard. Turns out it's Nice, not Meese. Back home, we have toilet paper worth locking up. Wasn't always so. Mike and I used to hang the Sears and Roebuck catalog in the outhouse, and even though we called it Rears and Sorebuck, it was better than that rough toilet paper with the splinters in it. Didn't cost anything either. We're in Sicily now, in Sant'Alessio. Our hotel overlooks the sea, and a nearby castle has been here since who knows when. First mention of it in the 12th century, they say. The 12th century. Walter Wilson says that so much sea in history makes him feel insignificant. Guess some people are just born small. I told him it makes my troubles seem insignificant,
but I'm still a VIP. The Rock of Gibraltar always wondered what it looked like in person. The hotel we're staying in encompasses an 8th century mosque and a Moorish well. Hotel was built just a few years before I was born, but it's in better shape. I'm more like that rock out there, seen a few battles, but still here, and you can see me coming from a mile away. We're flying out of the new Leonardo da Vinci airport day after tomorrow, which I guess makes us a flash in the pan in the Eternal City. They gave us a bus tour when we came in yesterday. Seems like the kind of place where you could have secrets, the way the streets wind around and hide from each other. Walter asked me to have a coffee with him tomorrow. Told him I'd see how I feel in the morning. Thank you.
Based on his collection and my collection and the Museum of Modern Art collection of Girls Standing on Lawns, there is a book that's coming out now, published by MoMA, called Girls Standing on Lawns, written by Daniel Handler, who's also Lemony Snicket. So it's a wonderful way of looking at wandering around and basically stumbling around the world and saying, there's something that makes me completely happy this moment, I must have it. So I also collect moss in a very higgly-piggly manner, and I'm not even sure it's always moss, it just might be a clump of something, but I take it home and it might have been Thomas Jefferson's moss or somebody like that, anyway. So my mother and her family left this little shack on the border of Russia and Poland, in Belarus, and in 1932 they decided enough pogroms, enough with curfews and the occasional murder and the mad dog attacking them, and they would leave this little shack. And what I love about this photo is that they're all they're miserable, but they're industrious, and it speaks a lot about how they are always doing something, polishing or sewing or mending, and that's really a part of my life that I find very fulfilling. Anyway, so they left the little town of Lenin on the River Sluch, and they took this boat from Constanza, the SS Polonia, and the only story that I have about that is that a sailor fell in love with my mother, who was very, very beautiful, and gave her an orange, and that's the only family lore that exists about this trip. And they came to what was then Palestine, and they lived in Tel Aviv, which was the white city and an extraordinary melange of unbelievable characters and music and tango and cafes and writers, musicians, architects, everybody fleeing and coming to this city where it was the new modern city of hope. And at the same time, around 1933, Bronislaw Huberman, who was a Polish violinist, realized that things were getting very bad for Eastern European Jews and it was time to get out. And what he decided to do was to form the Palestine Philharmonic and to convince Jewish musicians and their families to leave Europe and come to is Palestine to create the Philharmonic, which he did. At the same time, Arturo Toscanini, who's on my right, standing here with the general manager of La Scala, Gatti Pezzazza, a good friend of his, was having a lot of trouble with Mussolini and being targeted by him and really getting very confrontational. At the same time, he was invited to perform in Germany, and he said, I'm not going to do that. So he really was becoming a very, very staunch anti-fascist and acting accordingly. And of course, Huberman knew his reputation, obviously, was for that was all over the world. And Huberman invited him to come to Palestine and said, why don't you conduct the first performance of the Palestine Philharmonic in this country? And he said yes. So there they are sitting on the promenade of the beach in Tel Aviv, and it's December, it's rather chilly. And the program consisted of Rossini and Brahms, Schubert, and had advertisements for coffee and for eggs, because of course that's what you would advertise in a concert hall. You should get some fresh eggs in the morning. So the performance was an epic event and a tremendous success, and really something that the whole world was watching. Great jubilation among all the people. And this is Toscanini taking a bow at this concert, wearing this these pants and this jacket, obviously, that he wore to perform. His son-in-law was Vladimir Horowitz, and Vladimir Horowitz was, in my opinion, the greatest pianist of the 20th century, and he was married to Toscanini's daughter, Wanda, and Wanda aspired to be a singer, but Toscanini, who was kind of ruthless, wouldn't let her sing because she wasn't that good. She was terrible. But anyway, Horowitz became somebody who was very important in our family. And so, in 1954, our family moved to New York, and we moved to the Bronx, and of course, clearly the center of culture in our family was this thing between my sister and me. But we really did live a really wonderful life, and we moved to the Bronx, to Riverdale in the Bronx, and I took piano lessons and ballet lessons, and it was an extraordinary time of great optimism, and I really enjoyed every bit of being in this new country. At the same time, maybe a few years earlier actually, Toscanini also emigrated to America, and he too moved to Riverdale. Here he is with his wife and his grandson, Walfredo. They lived in Wave Hill, what is now a public park, but was then this magnificent estate not far from where we lived. And here he is frolicking about with his granddaughter while we were probably going to some, you know, Bosun restaurant on, Riverdale, Johnson Avenue. He was living a much more cultured life. But I continued my piano lessons, and I went to the High School of Music and Art, which was on 135th Street in St. Nicholas Terrace, and it was called the Castle on the Hill, and it was really an extraordinary place where wonderful artists and musicians met as teenagers. And so I had studied the piano, and then I was in the chorus there. And I also, like Wanda, sang really badly, but they let me stay. And what we would do is that we would say to each other, meet you at Toscanini, where I have to finish this candy read. That's really a stupid call. So we would say, meet you at Toscanini, which was his bust in between the two elevators in the school, and then you would meet somebody you were madly in love with and hope wonderful things would happen and trysts and great romances. Anyway, a year ago, Toscanini dies in the 50s, and Toscanini's grandson, Walfredo, who is in his 80s or 90s, also dies. And it turns out that he has the Toscanini estate. So what happened was that there was an ad in the paper.
Doyle.
Doyle, right. So Doyle Auction House had an ad in the paper. So we're reading the paper one morning, reading, you know, first the obituaries, of course, because I collect obituaries also, and who wouldn't and who doesn't, but at any rate, there's an ad in the paper that says that the entire Toscanini estate, sofas and silver and paintings, and all of this is for sale, including Toscanini's pants. So I race over there like a crazy person to see the preview, and of course I see the pants that are hanging there, and they are the same pants that he wore, and they're identified as this, the same pants that he wore to conduct that concert, December 1936, the Palestine Philharmonic, and they're going up for sale, and I said, those pants shall be mine. So when the auction came up, I was really terrified, and you know, of course, very nervous and eager and yearning and all of those things, and I was, you know, fretting that they must be mine and they shall be mine because they're these anti-fascist, they're these anti-Nazi, you you know, love of Vladimir Horowitz, who probably sat in his lap at some point. You know, Tel Aviv, clearly if he had seen my mother, he would have fallen madly in love with her, and perhaps, you know, they would have had a relationship, and my name would be Myra Toscanini, but that's another possible road to take on this. At any rate, the bidding was fierce, and I thought, well, will the fates be with me? And in fact, they were, because I got the pants. I won them in auction.
First pressing of these had a unique serial number stamped in the lower right corner, and from what I understand, it was meant to be a kind of ironic gesture, implying that this was a limited edition, even though there was over 3 million copies, and I collect these 3 million copies. Here they are in record bins, and they're arranged by serial number. I've shown the collection in the style of a record store. People can come and browse the records, but I'm not selling them. I'm actually buying copies from whoever will bring them, and I'm still collecting copies, so if anyone here has a copy to part with, let me know.
Are you discriminant in?
First pressings only, with the serial number. Okay. Condition doesn't matter to you. a sensible person may ask why I want to have 1,000 copies of the same album. Well, it's particularly that they're the same album that makes the differences between them more apparent, that they've all become these unique objects with individual histories and are artifacts that tell this story of the last 45 years. And also, of course, having an all-white cover, all the age and wear is especially apparent, and people tend to treat it as a sort of a blank canvas, and often add, I'll show you some examples of some of my copies. This was Bob's. There are many, many more, but I made an album which is a composite of 100 different copies from my collection. So this is a composite of 100 different copies. As you can see, it's not anywhere close to white anymore. But I also realized the actual vinyl discs also age very uniquely. I mean, because of the physical nature of vinyl, basically no two discs after 45 years will play exactly the same. They skip differently, they accumulate dust in different places. Basically, they all play slightly differently. So the audio of this album is 100 different albums playing simultaneously. And basically, each side will start with the 100 layers basically synchronized. But because of the imperfections of the vinyl, they'll gradually drift out of sync into noise. So I'll play a selection from the album. And I'll play something in the middle of side one. Maybe some people will recognize it.
My guitar just
about this topic because we could talk about it a long time. I'm Nina Cacciadorian, and I have for a long time been trying to learn how to use a remote. I have for a long time collected books about shipwrecks. They have to be true accounts. They have to be by the shipwreck survivor, preferably. And this started because of this book. This book called Survive the Savage Sea was read to me by my mother when I was 7 years old, which is an unorthodox choice, perhaps, for reading to a child. This book was published in 1973, and it has to do with a voyage that took place and ended badly, although maybe not in the long run, in 1972 by a family of Scottish farmers, the Robertson family. Here you're seeing them at their moment of rescue, so I'm not, you know, spoiler alert, I guess. And here are the Robertsons before setting out. They were a family of farmers. The father had been a merchant marine and decided that he was concerned his children were growing up and really not seeing much of the world and understanding that the world was a big place. So he decided they were selling the family farm. They bought this old wooden schooner called the Lucette, and they set sail. And we're about a year into their voyage when a pod of killer whales, for reasons unknown, smashed the underside of their sailboat and it sank. And they had a few minutes to get off the ship and then were set adrift on a rubber raft with a little fiberglass dinghy in tow. They were sunk just off the coast of the Galapagos Islands, and for the next 37 days, six of them survived on this rubber raft and later this little dinghy. It was the mother and the father, two 12-year-old boys, an 18-year-old son, and then, most unfortunately for this guy, a student who they picked up somewhere along the way. They got stuck with this family. They had food and water for 3 days, and then it was really up to them to figure out how they were going to survive, get food, water, and somehow make their way to safety. About 17 days into this voyage, the rubber raft ended up having to be abandoned because it was rather threadbare, in part from sharks that were brushing up underneath the underside of it. So they have to leave the rubber raft, and they end up on, this is a recreation of the family reunited, you know, for this photo after the event was all over, but they wind up in this little tiny vessel. A fiberglass dinghy, which they named the Edna Mare, and six of them in there allowed for about 6 inches of freeboard. There was only about this much of the little dinghy that was sticking up above water. So I found out that the Edna Mare still survives. This little boat has wound up in a maritime museum in Cornwall. And, you know, I should also say, if this isn't clear by now, that I'm completely obsessed with this book. I read this book probably 30 times, if not more. I pretty much read it every year of my life. And the idea of seeing these objects in real was, I could sort of almost barely get my head around it. This story has obsessed my whole family, actually, to the extent that there's a picture in our family album, which my mother has captioned, recognizing this moment of rescue to be very similar to another moment taken of us in our family boat, just happening to kind of look like that other one. So, this is an illustration from Robertson's book, which shows you the turtle meat and fish that they often manage to catch by ways. I won't go into details because this really will be a half-hour talk about just this, but a good drying day. And there are these fascinating illustrations throughout the book that show some of what they did to kind of, you know, to stay alive. And one of the most fascinating diagrams to me, especially as a child, was seeing the disposition of bodies at night in Edna Mare, how they slept in this tiny boat crammed in there. And I like the word disposition also used in this context this way. So I met the Edna Mare. I went to this museum in Cornwall, and I managed to write to the curator saying, I'm an artist, I live in New York, I'm coming to the museum, I'm interested in shipwrecks. I sort of made it sound like a project, but honestly, and maybe it will be one day, but I just needed to lay hands on this thing. And it really was a kind of like seeing a strange and holy object. It is tiny, it is so small. And I stood there with this diagram looking at this going, I cannot believe it. I was taken upstairs and also allowed to look at some of the artifacts that survived the voyage that they managed to kind of haul up on deck. Bits of food, parts of
tools that they had used to, you know, catch fish with. This was a sort of amazing thing to see the logbook that constitutes the text that became the book that Douglas Robertson, the father, kept along the way. The family tartan, which had wound up in a sewing kit that they hauled aboard as they saw it drifting by right after the ship sank. All kinds of things. And as the curator stood there sort of telling me about what these different things were, I was sort of finishing a sentence for him and saying, he would say, this is a bottle of turtle oil. And I would say that they accumulated on the 13th day and that they also used with the enema tube to give them saltwater enemas to absorb more water. And he would sort of look at me and wonder what it was about all this. And at one point I had to ask him, does anyone ever come here to see these things? And he said, not really. This is where it all started for me. And I guess the kind of ongoing interest now, the rest of my life, has been to find more of these kinds of stories. I wanted to follow with this book. I'm only going to speak about four books from my collection to keep this quick, but this story sort of follows logically, in part because it's also a story about a family that got shipwrecked. In this instance, what motivated this family to travel was crooked teeth, because this family, the Wortmans, living in Alaska, had three children, and all of them really badly needed orthodontic work. It turned out, given how remote locations were, that the closest orthodontist was 80 miles away over some of the roughest water in Alaska. And then once you got there, you had to drive about 96 miles by car. So they used to make this trip for the sake of these straightening the kids' teeth, you know, once every year or so. And on one of these fateful trips, unfortunately, they hit a storm that decimated, destroyed the sailboat, and they all had to swim for their life, and then an absolutely horrific story follows from that point. But I wanted to read you a little excerpt of this, because I think there's some pretty remarkable parenting that goes on in this moment. The father writing here has a very sort of peculiar voice. I think that's one thing that interests me in these books, is sort of how people present the dilemma that they're in and the type of temperament and tonality that this takes on. So we are here at a point in the story where the sailboat is sinking from underneath them. They've all put on their life jackets, and they basically have to swim through very rough surf to the shore. And everybody is freaking out, basically. And so the father says, this is him writing, "We won't be able to help each other," I told them. "Each one is on their own. Just grab rocks and pull yourselves out when you get to shore. Don't let the water drag you back, or you will die." So two of his daughters go in, and he sees one of the daughters, the younger one, panicking and hugging her sister, and basically in the process of trying to clasp onto her sister, starting to sort of sink them both. So he says to this young girl, "Jenna, listen to me. You'll kill us both this way. I can't help you. Nobody can help you. We all have to make it by ourselves." And they do, but I have thought long and hard about that scene. This is a very famous shipwreck story. I'm not going to summarize this one for you because you probably all know it, but my experience of reading about this for the first time had a very strange kind of inflection that came from something that happened in the book itself. There's a moment in the Shackleton saga when one of the men, some of the men have been left behind, some of the men have gone to get help. One of the men left behind has to have an amputation done to his foot. And you can imagine they don't really exactly have a surgical situation there, or tools, or any anesthesia, etc. So there's a rather grisly scene where they amputate the foot. So I read through that in the book, and then about 30 pages later, they are amputating his foot again. And I thought I had, at that point, gotten a little loopy myself. I couldn't figure out what was going on. I kept thinking, I knew this happened. I just read this. Well, it turns out in my copy of the book, two signatures had been found in of that scene by accident. So I really was reading about the amputation again. And it makes me really love this particular copy of this book for that reason. Okay, so I will finish with a book that I got really for the beauty of its cover and the title, which I think is also very beautiful and metaphorical, "Handling Small Boats in Heavy Weather," by Frank Robb. I bought this at the Kinistic Seaport Museum used book section. So reading it from the dust jacket. Frank Robb does not tell you how to run for harbor. Instead, he explains what to do when shelter is impossible, when you are in the middle of a storm and miles from anywhere. And it goes sort of, there's a sort of tough guy tone to this book. Like, you know, he's not going to tell you how to get to safety. He's going to tell you how to stick it out, is sort of the thematic here. But the thing that's kind of fascinating in the book is that there are these pictures of waves that kind of relentlessly and without explanation appear. Just one horrible wave, and then another horrible wave, and another horrible wave everywhere, just one after the other. You know, with no real information here besides just trying to kind of scare you. And he occasionally describes the Willy Waw wave or other types of waves. And there's a kind of macho, tough guy tone to other parts of the book. Reading here from a chapter where he says, it is difficult to see how one could sail or otherwise propel such a boat or even exist happily aboard, so the shape of your ideal cruiser must depart considerably from this simple conception. He's talking about boat design here. However, we can all get one clue from this. Nature prefers curves, and in parentheses, don't we all? Then there's a wonderful section on fatigue, where he talks about what he calls the three witches. I'll read you a section from here. Fatigue is a spell cast over the human mind and body by three wicked witches of the Lack family. They work together, and their names are lack of food, lack of comfort, and lack of sleep. Lack of food is the least dangerous of these harridans. And he goes on a little while, then he says, this is not to say I am against food. I've been eating this stuff for years, and it is my favorite dish. this way. So the tone of this one is, it's really good. He goes on to talk about sleep, and he says, in fact, sort of quite poetically in a way, the worst of the witches and the one the most to be guarded against is lack of sleep. Her spell does not operate when you're off soundings, because no matter what the conditions, if you've got lots of sea room and you feel sleepy, you can put the yacht in a defensive position, curl up in your bunk, and go bye-byes. If you are really tired, you will sleep, no matter what sort of hell is breaking loose outside. And he ends by saying, and here's what I like so much, and perhaps the reason I like shipwreck books so much, is that there is some kernel in every one of these books for me of practical advice, of some, you know, some moment when I feel like a small boat in heavy weather, and there is something from one of these books that I will remember by way of sort of steeling my nerves or giving myself some courage. And in this one section in this book on fatigue, his tone suddenly changes, and he sort of starts to sound very much like a caring parent when he says, if you pick the bones out of this article, you will find out that this matter of avoiding fatigue boils down to eating regularly and sensibly, keeping yourself and your quarters warm and dry, and getting about 8 hours sleep a day. So that's what you gotta do.
Remote controls for sale, and if you buy, you want one, you have to buy them all. This is how they're sold on eBay. These collections, just by virtue of the fact that I can find them, makes them interesting to me. That you can, people are selling televisions, they take sideways pictures. And so I use them, and I don't really do much to them. Monitors, like offices going out of business and wrapping up the monitors, and they're sold in lots. And then there's collections of, so thinking about the TV, this is a collection of images of televisions for sale on Craigslist with flashes in them. the flash, I was fascinated by the flash as a kind of self-portrait of the photographer. but they're actually not that interesting to me. What's really interesting to me is sometimes if you really look closer, you see things in the reflections of the televisions. And so this is an example of some of them that I found. These are the screens. I cut out just the screens. And one of the things that is really fascinating to me about these, actually, is number one, like the kind of messes that you're seeing reflected in the television. And also, like that middle one, it looks like the guy's legs are open and there's something going on between the legs. So that reminded me of this phenomenon that I often talk about when I talk about my work, which is reflectoporn, which is something that... my collection of reflectoporn, but you can find it anywhere online if you do a Google search, reflectoporn. It's a phenomenon that happened on eBay, like when eBay just started and people were selling stuff. And what's really fascinating about these actually is like ulterior motives, like what are people thinking when they're putting these images up? These are under the propensity to sell the object, but obviously they're interested in doing something else. So I started to find my own reflectoporn in these televisions. So these are television screens that I've cropped out. And you can see, I have a pointer here, but right there. Which makes me feel like, and part of what's interesting to me here is how much of this is my own imagination after thinking about reflectoporn and looking at these television screens, and how much is actually really there. So here's a person, I think, and another person with a camera. I mean, yeah, that's the camera with his flash, or her flash. And then some of them like this, which are just really obvious. This person, I think, is a guy because of what's going on here. And I think is holding a laptop because of this here. And I love the bed. I mean, I think the bed is kind of beautiful. It's messy, but this is where I'm starting to think, there's so much intimacy revealed in this image. Like, the bed itself is the most intimate object in a home, really. You sleep in it, you have sex in it, all the things that you wouldn't share publicly go on in the bed, I think, I guess. here's another. This one's really kind of an obvious reflectoporn, although these are all inadvertent, because if we go back to look at these, I mean, they're tiny little images, so people who are selling their televisions actually don't really know they're being reflected in there. So, this one made me start to really think about the bed. And I, as you're looking for images, this is kind of a daisy chain of searches for me as I'm looking at images for TVs, looking for this kind of thing. I'm also finding images of armoires with messes in them, dirty laundry that someone neglected to put away. Armoires became a big thing for me. Like, if you're trying to sell your armoire on Craigslist, like, you can't even see the armoire, right? So what I think is really interesting about these is they say more about the people, and it's sort of like this subconscious. I started to think about these as a kind of subconscious need to connect, like some kind of like a subconscious need for a desire for intimacy, a need to connect with people you don't know, you can't see. There's somebody selling a bad... And if you were trying to sell your bed, I don't know. I think it's kind of great, really, in a way. Like, if you wanted to sell your bed, take a picture of it. Don't bother cleaning out. Why? I mean, you don't know who's going to be seeing this picture. You never know that person. So it's not like you're cleaning up for company or something. I love the. Oops. I love this. This, I don't know what that is. And then this is, I don't know, they're selling the bunk bed, but like you can't even see the bunk bed because the everything's over it. And then on the other hand, this is like somebody's bed that they're selling, and I really love the way they put this pillow here and this in the middle. So it becomes like the exact opposite. Like I'm presenting my bed for sale. I want it to look as best as I can. One of the things that I've been doing, so I started searching beds, and there's all these different. I'm thinking about this as a kind of, the bed as being the most private, the most intimate thing that we own. If people are selling it, they're putting this private thing into the public in this kind of anonymous way. And I'm finding these kind of underlying bits of personal stories in these. And if I'm thinking about the bed as a kind of intimate space and thinking about how you, how the sellers might be sort of inadvertently or subconsciously trying to reveal something in these images rather than just simply trying to sell the object. I've come up with a strategy of reading them like there's these that are revealing too much, the sort of psychological state of revealing too much. Than the psychological state of repetition, so that you get, so there's this trope, or not a trope, but a thing that happens on Craigslist, you've probably noticed if you've ever tried to buy something, where someone will post exactly the same image. I mean, really, don't know what any, what you're seeing difference in. There's no difference between, are these two? And so that's a sort of psychological moment of like the repetition, the idea of stutter, the repeating the thing over and over again without leading anywhere. And then not revealing anything. Subconscious manifestation of culture to present itself as repressed sexuality. So, for your viewing pleasure, the music, please.
Thank you. gravitational energy of each of these collectors, how these things are drawn to them. It's so apparent. They're all clever and interesting people. And I realized as I was going along that my collection was not exactly made in the same way. That all comes part and parcel with the strange format of my presentation. So in the show is a collection I made, I call it the Photography Liberation Front. And they're all no photography signs that I stole mostly while I was living in Europe. And I'm not going to really talk about it. But clearly my intentions are different than most. Rather than to reveal something which all these people have so beautifully done in these beautiful essayistic forms. My question was to prevent the concealment of something. So in that way, I'm trying to figure out as I talk, stand here, why I'm singing a song about this. Joel asked me to write a song. That's why I did it. But I think it also speaks a little bit to the photographer as collector. I'm a photographer. And I make many different projects. I have many different areas of inquiry. I'm not just the guy that photographs the beach with a large format camera. We know who that guy is. I always am following my instincts, much like a poet would do, which I used to be. My poetic practice has translated into songwriting. So do you want to do it? Okay, so I have a two-part presentation. One is a pop song called Artist Statement, about the Photography Liberation Front, and Nina's going to kind of back me up a little bit here. And that has created a kind of pop song for the credits to walk out of here with, which is called Unphotographable. So when this is over, we'll play a little Unphotographable. You don't have to listen to the whole thing. You can leave. The way you would for the pop song at the end. Don't make me read any. happiness with a little bit of this piece I call Unphotographed.
Thank you very much for coming tonight.